autumn is upon us. October, well, October means a lot of things. One of the things it means is that we share with the community the fall lectures. They've become a part of the life and fabric of our school. For some years now, we've been able to invite to the campus persons who had a lot to say. And along with them, we are always delighted to invite persons who have a lot to hear. Today, we have two special groups that we want to welcome to the fall lectures. One, our neighbors from 13 Baptist associations in the region. Over 100 pastors from those churches are here in attendance today on Good Neighbor Day, and we welcome you. There are a group of friends from the Ridge Road Baptist Church in Raleigh touring the campus today, and they are here, and we welcome you, one and all. Other friends and families and the family. The fall lectures are upon us, and we gratefully share them with you. Let's pray. Unto thee, O Lord, do we lift up our souls. O our God, we trust in thee. Let us not be ashamed. Yea, let none that wait on thee be ashamed. Let them be ashamed which transgress without cause. Show us thy ways, O Lord. Teach us thy paths. Lead us in thy truth and teach us. For thou art the God of our salvation, and on thee do we wait all the day. Almighty God, our Father, the Lord of our lives, we thank thee for this October day. Its gladness and its brightness inspire us. Its hope for new beginnings challenges us. Its hours waiting yet to be filled quicken us to duty. We pray thee today, let us avail ourselves richly of the opportunity where words of ours can cheer a despairing heart, where deeds of ours can brace a wavering will, where prayers of ours can serve to extend thy rule. There let us speak and do and pray in the strong name of Jesus. Amen. Dr. William M. Pinson, Jr. has visited our campus before. He's never been awake when he's here. He always changes time zones when he comes to Wake Forest, but he's never changed the time zone like he now changes the time zone. It is at this moment 7 o'clock a.m. biological time to Dr. Pinson, and he tells me that he really does intend to wake up sometime during the day. In Nashville last week, we were discussing a certain meeting that was going to be held somewhere about some subject, and he said to us, he said, oh yeah, they're going to have it way over there in the east, Denver, I think. So the guy is learning. How large is the land? He boarded an airship yesterday in San Francisco, traveled all day, got here just about nightfall last night. And he does that with some regularity. But we feel fortunate that he's made the trek this week for the fall lectures at our school. Dr. Pinson is a native of Texas. He has studied there in two fine schools, North Texas State University, from which he earned a BA in 1955, and Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary, from which he earned a THD degree in 1963, having studied with Dr. T.B. Maston in the field of Christian ethics and their application. He has furthered his education and understanding of ethics and other disciplines by study at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland, Texas Christian University, Columbia University, Princeton University, Union Theological Seminary in New York, Yale Divinity School, and the San Francisco Theological Seminary. Dr. Pinson has had three tasks chosen before going to the present one. In 1957 through 63, he was the Associate Secretary of the Christian Life Commission of the Baptist General Convention of Texas. In 1963, for 12 years till 1975, he was Professor of Christian Ethics at his alma mater, the Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. In 1975 through 1977, he became the pastor of the First Baptist Church in Wichita Falls, Texas, from which another seminary president, Dr. Landrum Level, had just gone to be the president in New Orleans. Then in 1978, just this year, Dr. Pinson has accepted the task as the president of the Golden Gate Baptist Theological Seminary in Mill Valley, California. He has written extensively. May I share with you the list of books which he has written? Growing Disciples Through Preaching in 1976, Applying the Gospel in 1975, The Five Worlds of Youth in 1974, The Local Church in Ministry in 1973, Contemporary Christian Trends in 1972, Don't Blame the Game in 1972, 20 Centuries of Great Preaching in 13 Volumes with Clyde E. Fant, Jr. in 1971, Right or Wrong with T.B. Maston in 1971, No Greater Challenge in 1969, Resource Guide to Current Social Issues in 1968, How to Deal with Controversial Issues in 66, Ambassadors and Christian Discipleship in 1963, and Out of the Darkness in 1962. He has three publications that are scheduled to be released during this academic year. Families with Purpose, T.B. Maston, An Approach to Christian Ethics, and The Bible and Life. In addition to that, he has contributed to many other books. I'm going to simply share with you the five most recent ones. Resources for Renewal, Broadman in 1975, Youth Education in the Church, Moody in 1976, Baptists and the American Experience, Judson Press in 1977, The Equipping of Disciples, Broadman in 1977. Dr. Pinson has written articles extensively for magazines and journals. He has contributed to tapes and cassettes of various sorts. He has traveled and preached in Scotland and England and Spain and Denmark and Mexico and Canada and Europe and in Mexico and the Bahamas and Greece and Egypt and Israel and Turkey and Syria and Lebanon and the Middle East, Australia and New Zealand, among other places. He holds distinguished memberships in the American Academy of Political and Social Science, the American Academy of Religion, and the American Society of Christian Ethics. His honors and denominational service are very wide and very extensive, and I'm not going to take any further of his time to share all of them, but suffice it to say, he's the youngest person, I think, who has ever been asked to serve a seminary of the Southern Baptist Convention as its president, and one of the best equipped. You're going to like him if you've never met him, and I'm going to enjoy having him on campus for 2 days. I really do esteem his colleagueship in the family of presidents, and I'm most grateful to present to you, Dr. Pinson, some of the finest seminarians in all the earth, along with our faculty and administrative colleagues, and I'm delighted beyond words to present Dr. Pinson, my friend, to you for the fall lecture. His lecture today will be Questions for Ethics.
Thank you, Dr. Lally. I've always heard that the importance of the person is in indirect proportion to the length of the introduction. Not only was your president a friend in the past in different ways, but we were classmates together, and I have enough on him to blackmail him. If any of you are having any difficulty at all with your grades, I'd be happy to meet with you after chapel. I've always enjoyed being on this campus. It, to me, looks like what a seminary campus in this part of the world ought to look like. And it has the kind of feel about it that I think a seminary ought to have. I enjoyed last night fellowship with the faculty, a distinguished group of men, but also a very warm and personable group. A number of you who are students I've been with and known in different places, at Ridgecrest and your college and university settings, and I am delighted to be here in spite of how early it is for me. Usually they put a cup of water on the speaker's stand. I think I would like coffee laced with no doughs in the morning if it would be all right. I'm going to take the prerogative of a guest lecture to change the order of the lectures. Printed in the program, it is indicated, as Dr. Lally has mentioned, that today was to be questions for ethics and tomorrow the issues we face. I'm going to reverse those. After I had pondered a bit longer the order, it seemed to me more appropriate to give the setting in which ethics is being done, and then tomorrow to deal with something with the approach of doing ethics in today's world. And I am particularly excited about the fact that we have a group of pastors here. Never did I enjoy anything more than pastoring a Baptist church, and I think nothing has grieved me anymore in my life, since my immediate family all are alive, than leaving the pastorate of the Baptist Church in Wichita Falls to go into seminary administration. I feel I'm where God has called me to be, doing what He wanted me to do, but that still does not take away the hurt of leaving people you love and the kind of personal relationship that you only find in pastoring. The fact of ethics in today's world is one inescapable fact. Most of what you read about in the papers and most of what takes place in the halls of Congress and in the chambers of the United Nations have to do with ethics. Not with Christian ethics, but with ethics. The need for ethical decision making is widely apparent. I served with the Baptist World Alliance as chairman of the Commission on Justice, Peace, and Freedom. We have been charged with the responsibility of writing a declaration of human rights for Baptists, for all Baptists, not just for Southern Baptists. This past year, we met in Manila, in the Philippines, for the drafting of that document to be presented in Toronto. As we dealt with such problems as torture, terrorism, political oppression, it became quite clear as we met with delegates from the Soviet Union and from Eastern Europe and blocs and from various countries in South America that we were treading on landmines at every turn. Ethics is a very touchy subject, always has been, I suppose always will be, and particularly when it has to do with life and death matters, with human rights and issues, with freedom and with oppression. I experienced there something that I had never experienced before, meeting with persons who were victims of much of what was happening in the turmoil of ethics in the world, sitting and visiting with a missionary who had a bullet stop within a fraction of an inch of his spinal column, having penetrated the backseat of his automobile and his belt because he had been caught in a crossfire between two particular groups of persons struggling for human rights in a country in Southeast Asia. Having harassing telephone calls awaken me every hour to an hour and a half, all night long, with voices on the other end either saying, "Are you an American citizen? What are you doing here?" Or even more unnerving, no voice at all, just heavy breathing. We live in a world filled with tension, with violence, with a threat of death, as people try to deal with those most difficult of ethical issues concerning life and death and politics and economics. We're also living in a world of ethical decision making made vastly complex by developments in science and technology. For 12 years at Southwestern Seminary, I taught the PhD seminars on the history of ethics. After I'd been through those about four or five times, I was struck with the fact that no matter where we dug into a particular slice of history, to study what the ethical teachings of certain persons were
it all came up about the same. The issues didn't alter much from century to century. Some of the responses did, according to whether a person was a mystic or a Puritan or an evangelist activist, but the issues changed very little because the world changed very little. And then suddenly there was an explosion of change calling for differences in dealing with ethics. It came first, I think, with the beginning of the move of Europe into the rest of the world to colonize and to victimize the Third World. Discussions about usury passed off the scene, and there came to be discussions about capitalism and the kinds of economic systems which ought to be. The monarchies and the feudalistic states faded, and the sort of ethical systems which had dominated for centuries evaporated in the sun of new democracies and new approaches to government, which brought new issues in ethics which no one before really had ever faced. And then there came the technological and scientific revolutions, which led to all kinds of different issues in ethics. Just recently, for example, the high priest of the new social biology, in a recent book to try to counter something of what he had said in his first broadside concerning genetic ethics, indicated that homosexuality was genetically controlled because it was important in the development of the human race for there to be certain persons who were freed of the responsibilities of family life in order that they could give more time to the development of the arts and to government and to the support of those who did have families. Almost simultaneously, the Medical Society in Great Britain decided that it was ethically all right for the physicians to, through artificial insemination, provide for the birth of children of lesbian couples. Now, there's a couple of interesting ethical issues. Homosexuality, on one hand, defended by a social biologist insisting that the genetic purpose for homosexuality was to provide freedom to do things that families could not do, while the physicians of Great Britain decide to even run counter to what the geneticist had indicated by providing families for those who would not otherwise have them. And caught in the middle of that is the Christian ethicist who was trying to work with genetic engineering and to deal with the issues raised by modern medical technology to face problems and questions which never before were dealt with. Some of the great ethicists of the past never had to deal with the kinds of issues which ethicists today must deal. I used to enjoy going through the topical studies in the history of ethics in which we would consider such things as war and peace, what people had said about it through the ages. And what they said about it through the ages didn't vary very much until came the advent of modern warfare. And then atomic warfare, and suddenly total warfare took on a different meaning. For not only was total warfare the involvement of total populations, but it was the possibility of total annihilation of all populations. And it threw into a different category the discussion in ethics concerning war and peace. So the setting of doing ethics in today's world is vastly different from the setting of doing ethics in any previous time. Primarily because of the rapidity of change brought about by technology and scientific breakthrough, creating issues which really have never been faced before. And it has caused a kind of fatigue on the part of ethicists and on the part of people who are concerned about social change. I lived in California once before, in 1970. In 1970, California was the center of foment for social change. The University of California burst with the free speech movement, which led into the anti-Vietnam effort and the ecological revolution. Sausalito, a little town around from where I live, one of the most famous small towns in the world, was the center for much of that activity. People living in the streets, preparing for demonstrations, bringing pressure for social change. And
Not far away in Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco was the center of the flower power, love power movement with the hippie people. Today, the signs of fatigue are everywhere. Nobody is much concerned about social change. And the great ethical issues of a decade ago have suddenly become ancient history. The University of California this year has pledged the largest number of sorority girls in its history. During the foment of the late 60s and early 70s, it was only through duress that you could get anybody to be foolish enough to join a sorority. Sausalito is a quiet little tourist town with people buying trinkets symbolizing the bay. And Haight-Ashbury has been a part of urban renewal, filling with neat middle-class Americans. In the universities, the topics have turned to quiet, safe research. It is a different day. General complacency has set in. People are either wearied with efforts that produced little or no fruit, or are simply burned out, or have blown a kind of mental ethical fuse as the issues became so complex and so numerous that they were not able to handle them. The setting also involves the larger Christian community. Again, a decade or so ago, the larger Christian community was very caught up in ethics, social change, broad issues, efforts to try to bring about some alteration in society. But this is becoming less and less true. There was a strong surge of the so-called evangelical movement, which began approximately 20 years ago and began to draw some stability and strength 10 years ago and is now becoming the dominant force in American Christianity. Now, I use the word evangelical in a way that I think I need to define it, because I do not include Southern Baptist in the group. Evangelicals are a breed created in this country primarily by a force reacting to liberalism and to neo-orthodoxy, trying to create an academically respectable approach to doing the Christian faith as opposed to fundamentalism, with Harold Ockenguy establishing a kind of seminary for the movement and Billy Graham being the popular spokesman and Carl Henry and Christianity Today being the published effort. It grew larger and larger through the various organizations and groups which spawned parachurch movements such as Campus Crusade for Christ and others. And now the independent Bible grace churches, the parachurch movements for particular causes such as evangelism or world missions or media, have caught the issues of American life and put them together around religious purposes and now form the dominant religious movement in America. The evangelical movement, while it has had some ethical input, particularly through its more responsible spokesman, has nevertheless been largely low in its emphasis upon ethics and high in its emphasis upon doctrine and church growth and missions and evangelism. I've made the statement, and I still think it's true, although I have been thoroughly castigated for it, that whereas Southern Baptists survived the ecumenical movement, I wasn't sure whether or not we would survive the evangelical movement. The reason for that is that we had almost nothing in common with the basic thrust of the ecumenical movement. We did not need it. We were large and strong. We were not in sympathy with the theology of most of the leadership of it. But with the evangelical movement, the theology is much like ours. The causes sound similar, but they're far more beautifully packaged than we have ever packaged them. And there's the effort for specialization which lends appeal. And there is a great attractiveness to people who form the rank and file of Southern Baptist churches, so that if the trend continues, I would predict, demographically and sociologically, that the Southern Baptist Convention will begin to decline in numbers and in influence as the money and the people, and in some instances perhaps, the brains and the doers begin to move more and more to the independent, non-denominational, Bible-type churches, to the evangelical movements here and there. And if those movements continue as they have in the past, it will be quite likely that there will continue to be a downplaying of the role of ethics and an upplaying in other areas. It's characterized by several things. For example, one, that it tends to be very personalistic and pietistic in its approach, with a major on personal devotional life and personal discipleship and personal evangelism, without much concern to social structures and social issues and ethical causes. It also, particularly in its charismatic expression, tends to be more experiential in its approach, more feeling-oriented, more emotional, so that the issue is not whether you do good, but whether you feel good. The emphasis is on church growth and evangelism. And because sometimes a heavy emphasis upon ethics and social concern can be counterproductive to church growth, because it alienates persons who are on the receiving end of criticism of the ethicist, there's been a tendency to downplay within the churches any prophetic note, any effort to stress ethics, and an upgrading of the smoothest and blandest type of gospel preaching. Just come and be saved. Only believe. No more is necessary. Come and feel good. Come and join our group. We promise not to rock the boat. There is even, out of some church growth syndromes, an emphasis that the churches that grow the fastest are the churches which are the most homogeneous, and therefore churches really need to major on a kind of purity in their membership if they want to grow fast. All black, all Hispanic, all middle class, all upper class. And that emphasis upon church growth tends, therefore, to diminish the emphasis of much of ethical concern, which says that all people have been created in the image of God, that all people are to be welcomed in the fellowship of Christ, that all churches are to be open to all people of all races, regardless of background or culture. I frankly think there are times in which a church, through its prophetic emphasis, may not grow, but it may be truer to the heart of Christ than the church which is growing rapidly. I think from the experiences I've seen in California, however, that it's quite possible for a church to be intercultural, interethnic, and multilingual, made up of people from different stratas and stripes of life, and still grow numerically as well as in depth. But there's a tendency to put church growth above the prophetic stream of the Christian faith. Added to this is that many mainline denominational groups have felt that in order for them to survive, they must soft pedal the ethical emphases and embrace the general tenor of the evangelical movement. Presbyterians, Episcopalians, the United Church of Christ, the disciples have all experienced rather severe losses in membership in the past few years. And after a while, survival becomes a more basic issue than anything. And in order to survive, a person or a group or a structure or a denomination will tend to do whatever is necessary to survive. On the other hand, there is an element within the evangelical movement which is very committed to ethics. There is an attempt to sort of right the ship which has lurched far to the right in the evangelical movement. Carl Henry has, through the years, sounded a rather strong ethical note. Leighton Ford, with the Billy Graham organization, has consistently struck out for a high profile in regard to Christian ethics. Moberg, a sociologist but an evangelical, has written again and again in the area of Christian social ethics in an effort to bring the evangelicals into that camp. And evangelicals for social action have met several times to draft various statements and documents and have begun their own publishing and resolutions program to bring evangelical Christians into that particular stripe known as ethics with a social dimension. Still, I would say that for the most part, the evangelical movement remains primarily low in its emphasis upon ethics and social concern and social change. In doing ethics, therefore, in the world today, we might as well face realistically and be aware of the setting in the world and within the larger Christian community of which we are part. And there you'll find, either because of the complexity of it or the frustration and failure of the 60s and 70s in dealing with social change, or because of new theological emphases, or because of the problems of survival or church growth, or a number of other factors, that there is either an apathy or an indifference or sometimes an antagonism toward Christian ethics. A second thing to doing ethics in our world is to be aware of the changes within the Southern Baptist Convention, if we are doing it as Southern Baptist, and I am. One of the changes which has come about is that we are no longer as homogeneous as we once were. There was a time when you said Southern Baptist, everyone knew who you were talking about. You were talking about honkies who lived in the South. You were talking about someone like Begin could say, "Shalom, you all, too." You were talking about people who were, for the most part, segregationist and perhaps for the minor part racist, who were generally either rather wealthy as the aristocratic portion of the South or were common laborers and generally middle class people. That's what you were talking about. You were talking about a region. You were talking about a particular lifestyle. You were talking about a particular kind of person, identifiable sociologically, but no more. When you talk about Southern Baptists today, you're talking about people who are black and white and brown and yellow. When you speak of Southern Baptists, you're speaking of a group in which the fastest growing part, percentage-wise, are ethnic and racial and language in their makeup. You're talking no longer about a regional sect, but you're talking about a national denomination which stretches from coast to coast and from border to border and beyond. For interestingly enough, some of the fastest growing and most prophetic Southern Baptist churches are in Canada. It is true they're in Southern Canada, and I suppose therefore can be genuinely Southern Baptist. But we are no longer the homogeneous group we once were. We are different, with different thought patterns and different lifestyles and different cultural backgrounds and ethnic insights and language patterns. And when you sit down with a group of Southern Baptists, like I must every week, one of whom pastors the largest Baptist church in the West and it's Chinese, and another is pastor of a church in the largest minority group in the state, which may become the majority group, Hispanic. And another is Korean, and another is Vietnamese, and another is Portuguese. And you try to communicate, you begin to realize that the thought patterns and the thought processes and the traditions and the language of Zion that was spoken in the East Texas churches in which I grew up are not the means of communication anymore. And the issues which were so important in my East Texas church, dancing, drinking, excuse me for mentioning, smoking, were no longer their main issues. They're talking about the Brown Revolution and about the problem of ethnic relationships with blacks and Hispanics and Orientals and Anglos living in large metropolitan areas. They're talking about the issues of how do cities survive in our kind of day. Flying into Los Angeles the other day with a man, he said, "Look out the right side of your plane window." I looked out the right side of the window. He said, "Look out the left side." I looked out the left side, wondering what he was about. And then he said, "You have just looked down on more people than live in your native state of Texas." How do we do church? How do we do ethics in that kind of cosmopolitan, inter-ethnic, intercultural population mass? We're no longer homogeneous either in our economic divisions. There was a time in which most Southern Baptists were generally the same economically. We're no longer that. We are the poorest and we are among the richest. We have had upward mobility in regard to economics, which has caused all kinds of strains as people have moved out of their middle class ethic into the upper class ethic and have tried to relate that. We have also changed in regard to education, for we were once an illiterate people with an illiterate clergy, but no more. We have become more and more literate, with education being the norm rather than the abnorm, and as such it has also created tensions because our people now tend to be more cosmopolitan, more understanding of the world in which they live, more aware of other cultures and other religions and other ways of doing ethics. And we therefore have been affected by what has affected most of our nation, and that is an increasing kind of tolerance. I've experienced this in some of the moves I've made in the different parts of the country in which I live, to realize that when you bring people of many diverse backgrounds together, and no one of them dominates, like Southern Baptists so long dominated Southern culture, that there comes to the top, rising almost like cream, a sort of unwritten rule that the summum bonum for that society now must be tolerance. That you cannot exist with divergences unless everyone is tolerant of those differences. That's quite different from the way that many of us grew up, where we were part of the dominant group, racially, religiously, politically. Everybody else had to accommodate to our standards. Suddenly we find ourselves part of a nation which may no longer have a majority. California is an interesting place to live because it's kind of the harbinger of the future. One of the national television companies did a special on the county in which I live, Marin County, called I Want It All Now, complete with nude women and peacock feathers and hot tubs. It's amazing how much our applications increased after that special. The thing pointed out in this special was that paradise is not found outside of you, it's found somewhere inside of you. But that the reason why Marin County is important and why California is significant is that all of the major social revolutions of the last few decades have begun there. This concerns me because California will be the first major state. Hawaii already is, but it's a rather small state in regard to population. California will be the first major state, the state with the largest population, without a majority. The first state with all minorities. And to watch what happens in that kind of culture is that everyone becomes super tolerant because the only option to that is chaos and even social warfare. How do we do ethics as a convention set in that kind of changing mold in which we no longer find ourselves the dominant group, but more and more less so? And if you think that in the Southeast you're protected from all of that, check your demographic trends. And you'll discover that what's happening in the rest of the nation is happening here. It's happening in the Southwest. The people who are moving into the major metropolitan areas are not the people who were moving in a few years ago. There was a time in my native state of Texas in which, in order to build a new big Baptist church, all you had to do was to stick up a building in an appropriate place and just get a few people together, because the persons who were moving to town were coming from the rural areas of Texas and Louisiana and Arkansas, and they were nearly all Baptist. And as they came to town, they looked for a Baptist church. Now the people who are moving in are coming from Iran and Saudi Arabia and from New York and from Chicago. They're coming from the ice belt to the sun belt. And as they come, they're not looking for your local Baptist church. And as that demographic trend continues, we will have an entirely different sociological setting for how we do ethics as Baptists in our kind of world. Another thing to note among Southern Baptists is that there's been a shift of the ethical impact center from the seminaries to the denominational agencies. A couple of decades ago, the seminaries dominated ethical thought, ethical impact among Southern Baptists. This is where the writing was done and where the creative thinking was done and where the input was made. There's been a shift with the growth of the Christian Life Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention and the various state Christian Life Commissions. There has been now the building up of teams of persons here who are specialists in the area of Christian ethics, who don't have to spend time going to committee meetings and going out and enlisting students and teaching classes and doing all these kinds of things, but can spend almost full time researching and writing and speaking. They also have the advantage in their travel of being able to cross-pollinate more frequently, and to be in Washington, and to be in the state capitals, and to go to places where the experts are, and to receive the sort of input there, which those who teach in seminaries frequently find it very, very difficult to do. I don't know what this ultimately is going to mean for us as a denomination with this kind of shift, but I think it may say something about the needs for the altering a bit of what we do in regard to theological education and the making it possible for those who teach to have something of the benefits of those who serve in denominational positions. Else we lose the input at the level at which it's so much needed, at the formation point in seminary life. Third thing that's happened, we're no longer homogeneous and we've shifted from the seminaries to the denominational agencies, but we have also tended to capture ethics into the large bureaucratic structures of the denomination. Ethics is the program assignment of the Church Training Department and the Baptist Sunday School Board. And churning out materials, the Sunday School Board tends, therefore, to be the primary disseminator of ethical input into Baptist life. But what happens when your major output comes from your major bureaucracy, whose existence is primarily determined on the basis of the sale of literature to a constituency which is rather wide in its range of interest and prejudices and backgrounds? Usually what happens is that you get it down to the lowest common denominator in order to make it more palatable to the most people. That's no criticism particularly of the Sunday School Board, for of any of the major denominational agencies, they've maintained an edge of creativity that you'll seldom find. But it does say something of the danger for Christian ethics within Southern Baptist life in the days ahead. A third major thing in doing ethics in our kind of world is to see what issues that we must face and deal with. Let me outline these, for I want to deal with them more tomorrow. There are certain basic ethical issues which we as Southern Baptists must grapple with and are having to grapple with. One has to do with the question of authority and the relationship of the Bible to that. Is the Bible to be the sole authority in regard to ethics, or is it one of a number of authorities in regard to ethics? If it is the sole authority, is it a kind of rule book to which we turn to find out what we are to do or not to do? Or is it a sort of guidebook filled with principles that we must interpret and apply? Or is it a kind of book of examples on how people have done it in the past from which we can gain inspiration and guidance? And this immediately throws the area of Christian ethics into the lap of those who are doing hermeneutics. And biblical interpretation becomes a key issue for doing Christian ethics in our kind of world. And because hermeneutics and the whole issue of biblical authority is one of the hot spots of Southern Baptist life, threatening it not to tear us down the middle, at least to spin us off into various splinter groups, ethics will once again find itself in the midst of controversy. But not quite like it was. There was a time in which the biggest fights tended to stem from race relations. Now they tend to stem from how the Bible is related to authority in Christian ethics. Another basic issue will be that of freedom and responsibility. Is each person, according to Baptist polity, really free and responsible? If so, how much latitude is a person to be allowed in ethical decision making and conclusions before they are ejected from the group? And another basic issue is church-world relations. How much should a church be involved in Christian social action and Christian social ministry? Historically, there have been much involved, but how about today? And then certain applied areas within our churches we must deal with. The lifestyle of our church leadership, the salary scales, and the kinds of buildings built and lived in, church state and taxation, the role of women in churches, emerging family patterns and lines of authority, the issue of private education, the whole ethical, hard, tough decision of whether or not it is responsible for a Baptist church to have a private school which tends to foment increased segregation, the problem of race and ethics, particularly in the cities. And then related to society, what economic theories ought we to be behind? In our kind of world, what form of economic structure is most near to a Christian ideal? Within medical ethics, genetic engineering, and the problems in regard to abortion and euthanasia and artificial insemination, world hunger and the supply and distribution of world goods, drug abuse, alcohol and others, the media, the issues of poverty, the types of government, the size of government, the function of government, the issues are enormous. When I wrote the little book, Resource Guide to Current Social Issues, I worked for a year and a half putting together the resources for 40 different basic ethical issues and thought that we'd pretty well covered all the main ones. Someone asked me to revise that book the other day and I said, there's no way. First of all, nobody knows that much anymore. I'm not sure I knew that much then. Secondly, the numbers of issues are now so numerous it could not be contained in a single volume. And third, the material is changing so rapidly, we really need a computer to do that now, not a book. I think that says that for you and for me, as Southern Baptists, we need to develop a generation of persons who are particularly trained to do theological, biblical thinking in regard to ethics, but who also have specialized training in regard to different aspects of Christian ethics, so that they can understand the setting of the world and what is happening in secular research in society, and they can also understand what is happening within the churches and in scholarship in regard to the scriptures and to theology. And they can blend those two. No longer in the general way that we tried to do for years, in which a person was an expert in all areas, but in specific areas. So that we have a Southern Baptist who is an expert in economics and one in medical theory and one in family life and perhaps in each of those areas numbers of persons. And I hope that out of your seminary career, God calls you to be that kind of bridge builder between secular disciplines in ethics and theological disciplines in ethics, that we can work out what we must responsibly do as the people of God doing ethics in our kind of world. That means we need in our seminaries far more people who have PhDs in biology and physiology and chemistry, sociology, political science, and economics, who then get their heavy degree also in theology and blended together can somehow maintain the prophetic voice which we once had and may be in danger of losing. More about that tomorrow.
stand with me for the benediction. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and they that dwell therein. Thank thee, O God, that we're yours too, and that from the top of our minds to the bottom of our hearts, we can be your people in your world. Help us to be. Amen.